Welcome to Are We Alone? I am Seth Shostak. Weather is always a good conversation starter, and these days there's a lot to talk about. This summer, North Dakota sizzled at a temperature of 117 degrees. Vancouver broke its record of continuous days of rain. In Phoenix, even the cactuses wilted in the record drought. Bad for Roadrunner. Okay, this is weather, but what it portends about long-term climate changes and their impacts is clearly worrisome. Perhaps nowhere is this felt more acutely than in the Arctic right now. Glaciers, sea ice, and permafrost are all turning to slush. Scientists say that the Arctic is heating up twice as fast as the rest of the planet, and that, at this rate, all Arctic ice, including the massive ice sheet that decks Greenland, could be gone by the end of the century. Sheila Watt-Cloutier lives in Iqaluit, the territorial capital of Nunavut in Canada. Now, she remembers traveling by dog sled when growing up, but now the traditional Inuit way of life is threatened by rising temperatures, and Sheila Watt-Cloutier is not just going to watch that happen. She's taken the first international legal action to try and halt the changes in her homeland.
The ice is forming much later in the year, and it is breaking up much earlier in the spring, early summer. There are new species of animals, of fish, of insects that are finding their way up here in the Arctic that we have never seen. The ice conditions themselves have become very unsafe at times because the way in which the ice is forming is totally different from what it used to be. As a result of the Arctic sink itself warming, the ice forms differently.
Could you just expand on that a little bit? This idea that there are different kinds of ice and actually the conditions of the ice are changing. How so exactly?
Well, what's happened is that because the Arctic sink, the Arctic waters themselves are warming, the ice, when it does freeze in the winter, is freezing differently. There's more air pockets and so on that end up in the ice, and it forms differently. And as a result, our hunters, when they're going out and seeing the ice from the surface, looks normal, as though it would be safe and secure, is not holding to be the case. On many situations now, there are more and more accidents and close drownings, as well as real drownings that are happening. The glaciers as well are melting so quickly, where there used to be streams where hunters could safely cross, can no longer do so. And we've lost lives as a result of that because the streams, what used to be streams, are now torrent rivers.
Now, I had read some reports that there was even pressure for some native people to move further inland and away from the edges where the water meets the solid ground or the ice because it was just becoming too unstable. Are you seeing that as well?
First of all, we Inuit are coastal people. Just in Canada alone, there's only one or two communities that are not coastal. But in Alaska, there is much more alarm than meets the eye. There are certain communities like Kavalina and Shishmaref that are literally falling into the sea because there's so much erosion along the coast. And who then relocates these communities? Who covers all of that expense? There's no adaptation programs in place yet. There is no recognition, in fact, by some governments to address this issue. So these become major challenges for us, even politically.
Well, you said that governments have not been taking action, sufficient action. You have. And in fact, you've filed a petition, as I understand, the first international legal action against climate change. Could you please brief me on what this says and what you've done?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the world, as I say, is not acting as urgently as it needs to address these issues. And we know that the United States in particular, that is the emitter of 25% of all greenhouse gases in the world, is one of the only big countries that is not signing on to the Kyoto Protocol. And the Kyoto Protocol, in all of its weaknesses, is the only international instrument that we have to work with that brings the global community together to address these issues. And so we decided that the best thing to do to really put ourselves on the map is to launch a petition to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is Washington-based, to cite that the inaction of the United States is indeed a violation of the human rights of Inuit of the Arctic.
Are you actually suing the United States? Is that a way to put it?
No, it is not a lawsuit. It is not a lawsuit. We're not suing for damages. What it is a petition where we want we expect the commission to view our petition, come north and see for themselves and witness for themselves what is happening, what it is that we as Inuit have to lose in all of this, and also to hold hearings in Washington so that our hunters who have signed on the petition with me can testify in person what is happening to our environment in the Arctic and how it relates to the rest of the planet. And what we would want at the end of it is for every government, what every government should be doing, and that's to have absolute, mandatory, absolute reductions of greenhouse gases and deal with the issues of adaptation in the Arctic for its people.
So to be clear, was this petition directed at the United States in particular, and to what degree did you give consideration to other countries that have not signed Kyoto and developing countries such as China, where you see all these coal-based power plants on the horizon?
Well, we have targeted the United States because it is, as I say, it emits 25% of global emissions of greenhouse gases. It is one of the only holdouts besides Australia that has not signed on to Kyoto. We feel that if America is on board and is online and signs on to Kyoto, ratifies it, and does what the global community is already trying to do with the Kyoto Protocol, there is certainly no way that China and India or any other countries that are polluting this world that we know will ever come on board unless the United States takes the lead on these issues. It's just not going to happen. You know, the whole issue of climate change is about a disconnect. You know, and why we are debating in climate change in the first place is because people have disconnected from themselves and their relationship to their neighbors, a relationship with the environment, and which is why we are debating this issue of climate change in the first place. So the petition attempts to be the international voice of the hunter to try to bring those voices together and to have a sense of commonality with one another and to understand that what's happening in the Arctic is only a matter of time, that this will all happen to all of us wherever you may be living on this planet.
Do you have the sense, Sheila, that it wouldn't come to litigation if people could just come to where you are and see what's happening around you in the Arctic?
Well, that's what I mean by if people can connect to it, not just as a, you know, some abstract political issue or economic issue, not that the economics aren't important, but if they could really connect to it as a people issue, as a human issue, I think there would be many more people who would be pushing hard to make changes to economic policies that really are destroying an entire way of life of an entire people.
Sheila Watt-Cloutier, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you for having me and helping to tell the story. Thank you.
Sheila Watt-Cloutier is a Canadian Inuit activist. She spoke to us from her home in Iqaluit, Canada. Well, if take action is the growing theme regarding climate change, one writer thinks two famous outlaws can teach us what not to do.
There are three things I know for sure. I know Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid get it in the end. I know Jeremy Butts in the fourth grade was not born in outer space like he said he was. And I know global warming is real. Now, I know what you're thinking. How do I know Butch and Sundance didn't get to their horses and get away? We never see them get shot, after all. How do I know? You take two Colt 45s on one side of the village plaza, half the Bolivian army on the other, and do the math. I look at global warming in kind of the same way, only the Bolivian army in this case is the vast majority of the world's scientists. But instead of rifles, they have mountains of observations and computer simulations of melting ice, shifting migrations, and carbon in the atmosphere. And Butch and Sundance? They're a handful of non-scientist global warming deniers, armed with a bunch of rhetoric about how we have nothing to worry about. Here's a case in point. In May, the so-called Conservative Competitive Enterprise Institute launched an ad campaign saying we don't need to worry about the 6 billion tons of carbon dioxide the U.S. releases every year. Their reasoning? We can't be harmed by something we breathe out every day. No real science, just that claim and a picture of a girl blowing on a dandelion. Folks, that's like me suggesting we drink crude oil because it's made out of carbon and hydrogen, just like a BLT. In the words of Butch and Sundance, who are these guys? Who are they? They're a privately funded nonprofit made up of spin doctors and economists. They seem to think scientific evidence can be toppled with clever arguments and courtroom loopholes. They're fooling themselves, just like Butch and Sundance did when they thought Bolivian banks would be easy to knock over. And like Butch and Sundance, it may catch up with us in the end. The fact is that the Earth's climate is changing and will continue to change, regardless of how you spin it. The Earth doesn't care how clever you are, and come to think of it, as Butch and Sundance found out the hard way, neither does the Bolivian army. And so spin doctors and political strategists are in a little over their heads here. This isn't a game or a chance to wrangle over politics. This is the world we will create and give to our children. Deserts, melted glaciers, bleached coral, and all. So what's the truly conservative thing to do? For Butch and Sundance, it would have been to call it quits after jumping into that river to get away from Joe LaForce. For us, conservative means becoming more efficient and cutting way back on carbon emissions. Conservative is putting real muscle behind energy innovations that we need anyway. Conservative is making a few sacrifices. And then, maybe, 50 years from now, the human race won't feel like a couple hopeless fugitives, alone in Bolivia, staring down the muzzles of a few hundred angry rifles.
Eric Vance is a fellow at California Magazine. And now, from today's desert to Earth as it once was.
Imagine being on Earth 600 million years ago. You're standing on the shore of a small continent, a chunk of land the size of Australia, a puzzle piece of crust, recently broken off from the mother of all continents, Pangaea. A ridge of hills is behind you, and the ocean is in front. The hilly ridge runs to the horizon in either direction, rocky, forlorn, and covered in thick ice. There are no trees, no shrubs, no vegetation of any kind. Beneath your feet is a desolate beach of bare rock and sand, brown and sterile. Despite the fact that the sun is high overhead, a biting wind is coming off the hills, and the temperature is polar, minus 50 degrees. Shivering hard, you face the ocean, but there is no surf, no water. Just an endless broken field of hard ice, stretching as far as you can see, a world-girdling crust a half mile thick, jumbled, piled high, and seemingly immune to the sun's feeble rays. There is no sound but the wind. Nowhere is there any sign of life. This sterile, miserable place is Snowball Earth, and our world has been like this for 10 million years. It may stay this way for 10 million more. It's 600 million years B.C. I asked geophysicist Raymond Pierre Humbert how it was that Earth got that way.
The prime suspect right now is carbon dioxide. Almost everything in climate at some point involves either carbon dioxide or methane, which are two of the most important long-lived greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And so one of my French colleagues has this theory he calls fire and ice, in which there were deposits of rock that are very, very good at reacting with carbon dioxide and forming limestone, these so-called flood basalts. And so after these big eruptions, you have a lot of weatherable rock right on the equator where there's a lot of rain beating down. And so these could have increased the rate at which carbon dioxide is drawn out of the atmosphere and turned into limestone. And that sudden drop in carbon dioxide could have been enough to tip over the Earth into a case where it had too little greenhouse effect. Right now we have too much, but it could have tipped over the Earth into having too little, which would then freeze it over.
All right. So for whatever reason, the Earth becomes covered with ice. The oceans are covered with ice. Now, of course, you get some sort of what's, I guess you'd call, positive feedback here, because ice is white. It reflects more sunlight, which makes it a little colder, which means more ice, which reflects more sunlight, which makes it a bit colder, and so forth and so on. So I can imagine that you rapidly spiral down into this situation where it's minus 30 degrees centigrade, I think is a number you used. I've read even colder temperatures. I mean, it sounds like Antarctica, really. I mean, that's a kind of...
It's a lot like putting Antarctica right on the tropics.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, how long does this go on? I mean, how long did Snowball Earth last? Are we talking a week, a century, a million years? What are we talking?
Well, for the Neoproterozoic snowball, if it really happened, if the geological evidence really does solidly indicate a snowball, if it really happened, the estimates from other deposits and from dating of the glacial deposits and things like that, it suggests that it could have conceivably been as short as a million years. It could have been as long as 20 million years. It couldn't have been much longer than 20 million years.
All right, millions of years. Millions of years. Now, this feedback mechanism that I described, where ice causes the Earth just to get colder, which produces more ice, which causes it to get colder. I mean, it sounds like this feedback loop, this vicious pernicious and pretty uncomfortable cycle. It sounds to me like it would just go on forever. I mean, why does the Earth ever stop being a snowball?
Yeah, actually, it's a good question, it's actually one of the central unresolved issues right now. It's one of the prime subjects of my own research in this area, is how do you get out and how long does it actually take you to get out? And something I should point out is that if somehow you put the Earth in a snowball state right now, if you did something like made the sun flicker so that it got dim enough that you could freeze the tropics, even if you brought the sun back up to its normal brightness today and brought the carbon dioxide to its normal level, the Earth would actually stay in a snowball if you put in a snowball. That snowball state is actually accessible to us right now because the snow is so bright. It's just that we can't get from where we are to the snowball with any sort of normal climate fluctuation. It's what we call a bifurcation. There's an alternate state of the Earth right now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking now, you know, Mars has gone bad, and I don't think there's any bringing back Mars unless we intervene, I suppose, in some distant future. And Venus, it's gone the other way, hothouse, it's stuck there. How did Earth get out?
Right, so the way prime theory for how Earth got out is that once you chill it out so much, this reaction that forms limestone out of carbon dioxide in the air no longer takes place. You need liquid water for that on the surface. You need rain beating down on rocks. And so that reaction is gone, but you still have carbon dioxide coming out from the interior of the Earth. The CO2 builds up until it warms up by greenhouse effect to thaw you out.
But you say carbon dioxide coming out from the center of the Earth. Presumably what you're saying is that there are volcanoes erupting? I mean,
yes, actually, the volcanoes don't even have to erupt. It's not actually from the center of the Earth. It's coming out from the mantle of the Earth from just below the crust. But yes, volcanoes erupting, the mid-ocean ridge, all that sort of stuff, that continues even during a snowball. And so the carbon dioxide just builds up, and in about 20 million years, you can build up carbon dioxide to the point where it's about 20% of the atmosphere, whereas now it's only about 300 molecules per million or 380 molecules per million.
So we're talking of factors of 100 or 1,000 times more CO2 in the atmosphere than is normal.
Yeah, or tens of thousands, yes.
Wow.
Yes. And now the problem is that when you actually try to make this theory work, which is what I've been doing in my research, when you try to actually see what the climate would be like on a snowball with 20% carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it actually isn't really enough. Even that is not really enough to thaw things out. There are all sorts of new phenomena people hadn't thought of before we started modeling these things that actually inhibit the deglaciation.
Okay, well, one way or another, we got out of snowball Earth. Now, if it was because of all this carbon dioxide building up because, you know, as you say, volcanoes and other processes are just pumping this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and without any liquid water to wash this out of the atmosphere and put it back down into the bottom of the ocean is wallboard, really. I mean, that you're going to get these enormous CO2 levels in the atmosphere. So then presumably the ice begins to melt a little bit, and then you get a little less reflection of sunlight, so it melts a little faster, and then, you know, rather quickly, does this happen rather quickly? Everything sort of clears up and the ice goes away?
Yes, in fact. I mean, it's quite remarkable. Once you do open up the tropics, somehow or other warm up the planet enough that you just melt a little tiny strip in the tropics, then you have this runaway ice melting because you have high CO2 and then the sun beating down on the wine dark sea, if you will, which just heats up enormously and then melts the ice back. And so by my estimate, once you open up the tropics by hook or by crook, then after being in a snowball for 20 million years, you can melt all the ice in as little as 1,000 years.
Wow.
And then you're left with this ice-free, super hot world. And some people worried that after you did melt back all that ice and then you had all the CO2 left in the atmosphere, you would wind up in a runaway greenhouse and we'd turn into Venus, which we obviously didn't do. But I finally managed to do those calculations this summer, which shows that the Earth gets hot, but you're not anywhere near the kind of runaway state where you evaporate the oceans completely into the atmosphere.
We're talking with Raymond Pierre Humbert, who is a geophysicist at the University of Chicago. So we go over the course of a very short period of time, geologically speaking, from Antarctica to the worst of the deserts. I mean, we go from minus 50 degrees to plus 50 degrees centigrade. That's about what? Minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit to, you know, more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yep.
in maybe thousands of years. This doesn't sound like it would have been great for life. What sort of life was around at this time?
Well, yes, this is not an environment that any kind of multicellular life, animals or plants, could have really survived. But organized multicellular life had not really evolved yet at the Neoproterozoic. There were things like microbial mats, stromatolites, and so forth, colonies, but not what we think of as animals and plants. In fact, the animals and plants came in at the it's called the Cambrian explosion, which is suspiciously close to the end of the snowball, leaving people to think that maybe the snowball, the kick, really somehow got the whole process of multicellular life started. But what was around were fairly complicated single-celled organisms, the so-called eukaryotes that have a separate nucleus. And one of the difficulties in the snowball theory is figuring out how you make photosynthetic eukaryotes, brown algae, things that need light but are sort of delicate because they're complicated. How in the world do you get something to survive and be adapted to 20 million years where it's frozen to the equator and then survive this additional period of perhaps some millions of years when suddenly in 1,000 years they have to adapt to conditions where the coldest temperatures anywhere on Earth are hotter than the hottest part of the tropical oceans today? And thinking about just, you know, whether you can reconcile this with what we know about the biological record, that's a tough deal right now.
So,
biologists are thinking about that.
So what the biologists are saying is that you have this enormous stress on whatever life was here on Earth, is stress that maybe, you know, Zoloft really wouldn't help, this tremendous switch in temperature range, and that would have favored those organisms that were genetically plastic, the ones that could adapt very quickly, and consequently maybe that's what kicked off the Cambrian explosion. We got all these multi-celled creatures and essentially the prototypes of all the life that we see on Earth today. I mean, that's kind of their scenario?
It's just circumstantial evidence. There's no known evolutionary theory that actually draws the line that says how a huge stress like the snowball event would actually favor organisms finally taking advantage of this molecular biological mechanism that would allow them to make complicated multicellular life. But it's circumstantial, and we do know from other events, things like the asteroid impact that killed the dinosaurs, that often major innovations in evolution do come in the wake of mass extinctions. There's no mass extinction actually known at the time of the snowball, but it certainly was a major stress on life, and so you put the circumstantial evidence together with the effect of other catastrophes, and one is tempted to draw this conclusion that the snowball did have something to do with it. But biologically, figuring out how you get these brown algae, these photosynthetic complex eukaryotic cells, through the horizon and get them to survive, because they did survive, that's really one of the main open questions.
My doctors told me to avoid stress, so I got to ask you, are we in line for another snowball Earth? Is that going to happen again?
I couldn't say it's impossible, because the snowball state is always available. Even a billion years from now, when the sun is brighter, if you put the Earth in a snowball state, it would stay in a snowball state. But in order to get us into the snowball state, we would need to either, something would have to happen to reduce the solar brightness, or something would have to happen to make the carbon dioxide almost completely disappear from the Earth's atmosphere. I could say if some Buck Rogers space alien came in and somehow sucked all the carbon dioxide out of our atmosphere, we would fall into a snowball Earth today, very likely.
Yeah.
At least according to my
probably be the least of our problems.
That's right. Yeah, in that case. But we're really not very close to the threshold right now, and so. Right now, there's no plausible scenario that would bring us into this snowball state. So it's not something I'm losing sleep over, I can say that.
All right, not buying blankets. So finally, Raven, Snowball Earth, this episode, which our planet went through and managed to pull itself out of, but that was clearly not a good deal for life, the evolution of life on this planet, at least as long as it was a snowball. Could this affect our chances, do you think, of finding life elsewhere? I mean, is this something that presumably would happen on a lot of worlds that otherwise might cook up some interesting critters?
In fact, yes. This is one of the reasons I'm so interested in the snowball Earth problem, because it is an astrobiology and a habitability problem. This is a generic kind of catastrophe. This is an early life crisis that planets are all subject to, as long as they rely on greenhouse gases to stay warm, and as long as they have a water ocean. And so, if we think that planets need a water ocean to have some kind of life, as we know it, then both the runaway greenhouse catastrophe like Venus and the snowball catastrophe like we very likely had on Earth are things that the planet has to negotiate its way through. They're hazards that a planet has to somehow work with in order to remain habitable and have time for the evolution of life. So this is a very generic sort of thing. But if you have an ocean. Only if you have a water ocean.
Yeah, but if you don't have that, maybe it's irrelevant for life. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that the whatever mechanism it is that pulled us out is also generic. Raymond Pierre-Humbert, I want to thank you very much for being with us and talking to us about I guess he'd call it a cool topic.
Yes, thank you very much.
Raymond Pierre-Humbert is a geophysicist at the University of Chicago. Well, thanks to Barbara Vance and Nilang Pargi for their help with the production of the show, and also to our giant of a host, who I'm happy to say was awake for the entire program.
Well, I'm warming to this subject. And thanks to our producer, Molly Bentley. I am Seth Shostak for the SETI Institute, where our goal is to explore and understand life beyond Earth. Remember, we always listen, but sometimes we broadcast.